Our meditation today is in music and in silence. As usual, I invite you to do whatever you need to do to make this a meditative time for you. Sing along or hum along or just listen. Then let the music lead you into the silence and continue with your own personal meditations or prayers. Let's begin with hymn number 15, The Lone Wild Bird. 15:15. Please remain seated. I'm aware when I pick a sermon title that it goes out there on West Sanish Road. We have a large crowd today, so I'm wondering if that's because you all think you're right, or you all think the right is wrong, or maybe both. The book that Andy gave me as a starting point for this sermon is called The Righteous Mind. When we progressive types hear the word righteous, or its more condemning cousin, self-righteous, we tend to think of other people, not us. We envision, for example, the closed-minded, Bible-thumping fundamentalist who thinks he has the right and only way and that anyone else is depraved or evil. But when we think about it a bit more, some of us may admit that we have seen examples of progressive or liberal folks being self-righteous as well, spouting rhetoric that suggests that they have the right way and that anyone else is ignorant or evil. Think of recent reactions to the death of Margaret Thatcher. Liberals are holding parties to celebrate her death, are planning a protest at her funeral procession on Wednesday, and have successfully mounted a campaign to get as the number one song on the music chart, Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead. Liberals can be mean-spirited as well as self-righteous. I understand that people were hurt by Thatcher's decisions when she was prime minister. I had a similar reaction to the policies of George Bush when I lived in the States, and many here in Canada may feel the same way about Stephen Harper's policies. Still, these attacks on Thatcher as a person, especially at a time when her kids are mourning the death of their mother, just the whole idea of celebrating the death of an 87-year-old woman, it seems to me to be in poor taste. Liberals behaving badly. Now, of course, none of us would be so mean-spirited. And we are certainly never self-righteous, behaving as if our way is the only way. We Unitarian Universalists are respectful, open-minded, open-hearted. Our church's mission, which is on the front of the order of service, is about living compassion, being open to diversity and self-transformation. Well, I don't know about you. Maybe Canadians are less prone to this. But perhaps, upon occasion, you too have experienced the exhilarating rush of a self-righteous rant against, say, threats to the environment. Do people not see how serious this is? Do they not care about our earth, our grandchildren? Or certain politicians? How can people vote for a person like that? How can they be so ignorant? Or even the choice of a tapestry that hangs on the table. I won't support that with a quotation. My point is, whether it is a loud, passionate rant or a more subdued but cutting eye roll, self-righteousness can make us feel good, powerful, secure, smart. It feels so good to be right. The problem, as you know, is that though it may feel good, self-righteousness is really not that constructive. First of all, it turns people off. Even those who would otherwise be on our side, it's not attractive, nor is it convincing. Secondly, it makes listeners feel afraid to express any views that may differ from ours. It closes us down to learning. Moreover, it kills any chance of finding common ground or constructive compromise. And lastly, when we are self-righteous, we are not living up to our own Unitarian Universalist values. Respect, compassion, open-mindedness. Think of what we want to model for the kids growing up in our congregation. How we would like to teach them to express their opinions. Instead of saying in front of them, "Politician X is a bad man," we try things like, "I disagree with the way Politician X is leading our country. I am worried about the well-being of our earth and our people. I think the decisions X is making will hurt our environment and people who don't have a lot of money." So, self-righteousness does not work. The next question Unitarian Universalists often wonder is whether productive dialogue is really possible. Many of us have experienced the frustration of not being able to convince the other of our rightness, even when we are being civil about it. We are smart, rational people. Our positions are well thought out, supported by data, grounded in compassion. Why can't we just explain our reasoning to the other side and thereby show them the truth? John Haight addressed this question in his book, The Righteous Mind, the subtitle of which is Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. One of the major insights in Haight's book is that we humans do not use reason to figure out our views. We intuitively form our views, then use reason to justify our positions afterward. For example, Haight tells of a study he did for which subjects were given a fictional scenario in which a woman who works in a pathology lab is instructed to incinerate a fresh cadaver. She feels to do so is a waste of perfectly good meat, so she takes some home, cooks it, and eats it. subjects instinctively condemned this act as morally wrong, but had a hard time coming up with rational justification for their position. Haight reports, people made moral judgments quickly and emotionally. Moral reasoning was mostly just a post hoc search for reasons to justify the judgments that people had already made. That was just one experiment. The book is full of others. Based on this extensive research, Haight concludes that, quote, intuitions come first, strategic reasoning second. Moral intuitions arise automatically and almost instantaneously, long before moral reasoning has a chance to get started. And those first intuitions tend to drive our later reasoning. Haight continues, if you think that moral reasoning is that the moral reasoning is something we do to figure out the truth, you will be constantly frustrated by how foolish, biased, and illogical people become when they disagree with you. But if you think about moral reasoning as a skill we humans evolved to further our social agendas, to justify our own actions and defend the teams we belong to, then things will make a lot more sense. He explains with a metaphor, the mind is divided like a rider on an elephant, and the rider's job is to serve the elephant. The rider is our conscious reasoning, the stream of words and images of which we are fully aware. The elephant is the other 99% of mental processes, the ones that occur outside of awareness, but actually govern most of our behavior. Thus, if you want to convince someone of your own views, you need to talk to their elephant, their intuitions. Haight writes that, quote, Dale Carnegie was one of the greatest elephant whisperers of all time. In his classic book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, Carnegie repeatedly urges readers to avoid direct confrontations. Instead, he advises people to begin in a friendly way, to smile, to be a good listener, and to never say, you're wrong. The persuader's goal should be to convey respect, warmth, and an openness to dialogue before stating one's own case. If you really want to change someone's mind on a moral or political matter, Haight says, you'll need to see things from that person's angle as well as your own. Furthermore, if we are going to speak to the elephants, the intuitions, it would behoove us to be aware of the variety of moral standards to which the elephants respond. He calls them moral taste receptors. Again, backed up by extensive research, Haight points out that many Westerners, and progressives in particular, use only two or three moral taste receptors. We base our moral judgments on issues of care versus harm, liberty versus oppression, and issues of fairness. But he notes in other cultures, and in many conservative Western subcultures, people also factor into their moral compasses three other standards, things like loyalty, respect for authority, and sanctity. If you are going to understand the other, it is helpful to understand what matters to them. Recall that Haight said, if you really want to change someone's mind on a moral or political matter, you need to see things from that person's angle as well as your own. He continues, and if you do truly see it the other person's way, deeply and intuitively, you might even find your own mind opening in response. Empathy is an antidote to righteousness. Empathy is an antidote to righteousness. The heart is perhaps more important than the head in this context. My sermon title is Talking with the Right When We Think They Are Wrong. I must note, by the way, I do not assume that everyone here is politically progressive. In the States, We have Unitarian Universalist Republicans, a unique and fascinating kind of Republican. No, really. There was one in one of my congregations. He was a lovely guy. I assume that in Canada, politically conservative Unitarian Universalists exist as well. On matters of theology, however, we are by definition a liberal religion. We do not have a creed. We are the opposite of fundamentalists. We see many ways, not one way. So when I say we progressives, I mostly mean socially and religiously, though this will also apply to many of you politically as well. So, talking with the right when we think they are wrong. Consider moments you have been in this situation. Maybe at a Thanksgiving dinner with family members who are fundamentalist Christians. Maybe chatting with a neighbor who posts signs for conservative politicians you do not support. Maybe in a more public scene, a panel discussion or forum on a public issue in which you represent one view and others represent different views. It seems to me that when we approach these situations, it is helpful to know what our goals are. Picture yourself with your fundamentalist relative or neighbor or coworker or whatever situation is familiar to you. What are your goals? Are you trying to get your neighbor or relative to change their position? Are you trying to get them to respect your humanity and thus not see you as the enemy, even if they still hold on to their views? In the case of a public debate, are you trying to get the listeners to see your side, even if your opponent won't? Are you trying to open yourself to learning, trying to find potential common ground or potential compromise? In all cases, it seems that you have a better chance of a positive outcome if you endeavor to deeply and intuitively understand their view of things, listen to their experiences, the emotions of the other. What do they care about? What do they fear? Why? Which moral taste receptors do they use? Fairness? Loyalty? Care versus harm? Even if they ultimately stay with their position and you stay with your position, I do feel like there's something good in seeing the humanity in one another instead of demonizing one another. Perhaps you have had an experience like this, a heart connection moment with someone with whom you have differed in opinion. I remember as a teenager in Los Angeles, California, a conversation I had with a high school friend. Her name was Asha. Her family was from Sri Lanka. She was smart and gentle and kind. I respected her a great deal. One day, I don't know how, the topic of abortion came up. Good Democrat that I was stridently pro-choice. I was disturbed by tales of all of the women who had died or been traumatized by illegal abortions. I knew that when abortion was illegal, poor women and poor children bore the brunt of the negative consequences. I believed that the net suffering would be reduced if abortion was legal. My friend shared with me in her gentle way that she was against abortion. When I asked why, she simply said that she believed when a baby is conceived, when it is growing inside its mother, it is a life. And to harm, to kill this life, felt wrong and sad to her. It was the first time I understood that those on the other side of the abortion debate were not all heartless, misogynistic idiots. She was intelligent, caring, and very much in favor of women's rights. I was moved by her position. I was still a pro-choice person. I would still vote that way. But I would not so readily demonize or denigrate the other side. It does seem like even if we ultimately stick with our original position, the more we understand one another's heart reasons, the less likely we are to kill each other over such divisions. We might even become friends. This is the principle behind organizations like Seeds of Peace, which brings together Israeli and Palestinian youth. Or right here on this island, we have Pearson College, an internationally, intentionally diverse learning community, which brings together young people from all over the world. They are one of the 13 United World Colleges, the mission of which is to, quote, make education a force to unite people, nations, and cultures for peace and a sustainable future. Sometimes, through these sorts of heart alliances, real progress can be made. We hear of interfaith organizations in which the religious groups may differ on, say, gay marriage, but work together to help the homeless. Or pro-life and pro-choice people working together to support young and or low-income mothers. Through dialogue and heart connection, people can find common ground. Sometimes they can find compromise. A couple of years ago, I read Jack Hodgkin's novel, Distance, part of which takes place on Vancouver Island. I remember being surprised that the locals in the book were annoyed with the environmentalists, the people I thought of as the good guys. The author portrayed them as naive outsiders who did not know much about the local plants and conditions. Nor were the logging companies portrayed in a favorable light. The local people saw that neither clear-cutting it all nor preserving it all were useful solutions. Instead, they proposed a middle ground, a method they had figured out to harvest and replant in a sustainable way. I don't know how much of that was true. I looked up the Forest Practice Code of 1995, and I understand that there were a number of problems with it. But I was struck by the possibility of compromise between these two groups that seemed at such an impasse. It made me wonder what other kinds of compromises might be possible. I must insert here a caveat. In general, I'm encouraging us to try to be open-minded and open-hearted, to try to make heart connections with the other side, whoever that other side may be for us. This is easier for some than others. Sometimes, when the thing about which you and your opponent disagree is your own worth as a person, agreeing to disagree with a smile and a handshake is just not possible. It's too painful. When I was in divinity school in the 1990s, I spent a lot of time learning about the Christian right. I did a research project on fundamentalist Baptists. I read articles about the Christian Coalition. I visited a Baptist church and interviewed their pastor. I had lengthy, heart-wrenching conversations about gay marriage with my Pentecostalist co-worker at the Divinity School bookstore. It was fine for a while. I felt good about the fact that though my co-worker and I would still vote opposite ways on the issue of gay marriage, at least we would not raise our kids to bully each other on the playground. But after a while, all that diplomacy and attempting to understand the other took a toll on my spirit. I had to take a break and retreat into the protective arms of my supportive, theologically open, gay-affirming subculture. I saw this happen with a classmate of mine as well. She was one of the few African-American students in this particular class, and she was tired of explaining racism and the effects of racism to all these well-meaning white people. Being the bridge builder, especially when the issue is your own identity, can be exhausting and dispiriting. Which is why we need allies. Bless those straight allies out there who do the diplomacy of bridge building with the rest of the straight world. Blessed be the white folks who help other white folks recognize and understand the dynamics of racism. On all of these issues, be it race, sexual orientation, environmental protection, religion, or politics, blessed be the bridge builders. It can be easy to turn away from this work. It is easier and it feels better to stick with our like-minded groups, enjoying the camaraderie to be found in deriding the folly of the other side. Self-righteousness is so comfortable. I myself feel the lure of it. But when I stop to think, I realize that that is not who I want to be. I chose to be a Unitarian Universalist. I support the mission on the front of our order of service because it challenges me to be my best self. Opening myself to understanding the other, holding that person in compassion, even if I disagree with their views, that can be a spiritual practice. When I struggle with this practice, it helps me to think of some spiritual models that I admire. Thich Nhat Hanh, Martin Luther King Jr., the Dalai Lama, Gandhi. These are strong spiritual leaders working in the world or who worked in the world for many of the values we hold dear. Their work is grounded in love and compassion. They pursue justice through peaceful means. Many of them make the point that true peace can only be found through empathy, talking to the elephants. In the words of the Dalai Lama, quote, "When I speak of basic human feeling, I am not only thinking of something fleeting and vague. I refer to that which in Tibetan we call Shen Deng Wal Wa La Mi So Pa. Translated literally, this means the inability to bear the sight of another's suffering." He continues, "Given that this is what enables us to enter into and to some extent participate in another's pain, it is one of our most significant characteristics. It is what causes us to start at the sound of a cry for help, to recoil at the sight of harm done to another, to suffer when confronted with another's suffering." Another source reports that the Dalai Lama says that trust and friendship are necessary to be a contented human being, which he says tends to develop much better once we realize that all beings have a right to happiness just as we do. He says, taking others' interests into account not only helps them, it also helps us. Warm-heartedness and concern for others are a part of human nature and are at the core of positive human values. Imagine how the Dalai Lama might speak to your neighbor with the conservative signs. Imagine how Thich Nhat Hanh might speak to your fundamentalist family member. They could probably avoid the righteous rant, as well as the derisive eye roll. They might even offer a kind smile and ask about those things that your neighbor or relative holds dear. They would probably spend less of their energy trying to convince the other of their rightness and more of their energy trying to empathize and understand the other's experience. Talking with the right or whomever when we think they are wrong. Herein we have an opportunity to practice our faith. To open ourselves to understanding someone different from us, to practice empathy, to live out our mission, striving to transform ourselves and our world through compassionate action. So may it be.